Dow versus Guardian Life. Mr. Jensky.
May it please the court. As this court stated in its 1991 opinion in Matuszak versus Torrington, no plan, meaning a health and welfare benefit plan, can provide discretion to deny benefits for reasons identified after the fact. The appellant's position here, Your Honors, is that a de novo standard of review applies, not an abuse of discretion. But even if this court adopts an abuse of discretion standard in judging this case, then the trial court's decision still must be overturned because the trial court clearly abused its discretion. The trial court abused its discretion by making two rulings. The first, that the plaintiff did not exhaust his administrative remedies, and secondly, that the plaintiff has no standing before this court or before the trial court. Now, as this court said in Jenkins versus Local 705 in 1983, ERISA has been interpreted as only requiring a claimant to exhaust a plan's claims procedure. Thus, exhaustion of specific issues or theories is not required. On page 187 of the appendix in this case, we have a listing, and this is a listing that was actually prepared by Guardian Life that goes on for two pages. It's from June of 2000 to June of 2001. It contains 24 entries during that one period of time. So on average, two times a month, Dr. Joe was corresponding or at least talking with Guardian Life about the payment of his claim. That can hardly constitute failure to exhaust remedies. To read Guardian's brief, one would think that the one and only document that Dr. Joe requested during that one-year period of time where we had an exchange, 24 different separate exchanges, that the one and only document he asked for was the summary plan description. That is not the case. Dr. Joe was very careful in tailoring his request for Guardian's pertinent plan documents based upon essentially prior rulings of this court. What Dr. Joe demanded, and he demanded it twice, he filed two internal appeals, one in December of 2000, a second in April of 2001, and in each he requested the documents that specifically got to the reasons for the denials of the payment of his claims. Those two reasons were that his charges were not usual and customary, and that the treatment that he was rendering was not medically necessary. And in his two appeals, again in December of 2000 and April of 2001, Dr. Joe asked for the claims review procedures established and maintained for this plan, the claim review guidelines, including specifically the guidelines for chiropractic and acupuncture, which is what his treatment was, publications and databases or schedules used to determine usual, customary, and reasonable charges, one of the reasons listed for the denial, utilization review criteria and claim auditing and processing procedures, specifically with reference to the issue of medical necessity, again, one of the two issues used to deny his claims, medical necessity review documents performed by any medical staff or physician, and also please specify if the individual who performed any medical necessity review is qualified professionally and legally to perform the medical services which he's reviewing. These were the documents that he asked for repeatedly during a one-year period of time. He was repeatedly told, and to this day continues to be told, you're not going to get those documents. He can't possibly prosecute his internal appeal if he doesn't have access to the very documentation, the very reasoning that's used to deny his claim. He does not receive a full and fair review, which this court said is absolutely mandated by ERISA.
No other way to get these documents?
You can get the summary plan description, and that was only one of a number of documents that was requested. You can get the summary plan description typically from the plan sponsor or the plan administrator, using that phrase, plan administrator, to mean the welfare and benefit plan administrator, not just the health care claims administrator. And we do get into a little bit of a semantics problem here when we use the word plan, because sometimes it's used without definition when we use the word administrator, because again, sometimes it's not used, it's not defined as it's used. The complaint that we filed dealt exclusively with health care benefits. This is not a disability claim denial case. This is not a life insurance denial case. This obviously doesn't have anything to do with pension rights. It's confined exclusively to health care benefits. So in our complaint, in the plaintiff's initial complaint, we did refer to the plan, meaning the health care plan, not the benefit plan as a whole, in general. And we referred to Guardian as the administrator of that plan. And they clearly are, and they've admitted in the filings, the correspondence that was exchanged with Dr. Joe, and then subsequently in their briefing, that they, in fact, had the discretionary authority to make these claims denial decisions, claims review decisions. It was Guardian, and it was Guardian alone that decided what medical records they would request from a health care provider such as Dr. Joe. It was Guardian alone that decided which of those records would be submitted to review. It was Guardian alone that decided who would review those documents. It was Guardian alone that made the decision whether or not we're going to pay or deny these claims based upon our determination that they're not usual and customary or that they're not medically necessary. So for purposes of this appeal, there's absolutely no question but that Guardian is the administrator. The question then becomes, what does the administrator have to produce once the request has been made by a claimant in order to pursue his internal appeal rights? They have to produce those documents upon which they relied in making their denial. And their refusal to do that denies full and fair review. I would also indicate that it's a little bit hard to reconcile the two conclusions or the two rulings that the trial court made, because in firstly, the trial court decided that Dr. Joe did not exhaust his administrative remedies. It then decided that he had no standing in the first place, which begs the question, well, it suggests actually that he was without authority to do any of the acts that he did at any point in time during that 1 year period of time that I've referred to earlier, yet the trial court seems to be saying, but he should have done more of what he was not authorized to do. That simply doesn't make sense. You can't actually reconcile the two rulings that the trial court made.
You just insist that the Guardian is the plan sponsor, I guess.
Not the plan sponsor, the administrator of the health care.
Well, why couldn't you identify the plan sponsor then and ask for the SPD? And, you know, that's what the district court said. Your client didn't exhaust the administrative remedy.
We did.
Going to the plan sponsor.
We did, Your Honor, ask Guardian to identify the plan sponsor or the name, the appropriate name fiduciary, as that clause is used in ERISA.
So you weren't able to find out who that was then?
No, which suggests that they don't know who they're working for. I don't follow the logic of that either, and I don't think that that's a factually accurate response to begin
with. No way the insured could go to the company and ask who the plan sponsor is?
The insured could go to the company and ask for a copy of the plan or the summary plan description, typically of what is asked for and given. However, the summary plan description, we were concerned, would not be the one under which they were operating. Just as we ran into the problem with respect to the language concerning this standing to sue, this anti-assignment clause, the policy that was appended not to the motion to dismiss, it was raised for the first time in a subsequent memorandum. We read that policy to say that you could assign your benefits. They read it to say, no, there's a subsequent amendment. We didn't want to have that same problem with the SPD. Let's not get the SPD from the plan sponsor, only to be told later that, well, there's a different version under which we operate. Plus, whether or not the claims procedure is reasonable, as defined by the Department of Labor regulations, depends upon whether or not the claims procedure is set forth in the SPD. So that's the starting point. If they had told us earlier that Arlene Baker can't assign, make an assignment of her claim, we could have named her as a party plaintiff. She could be before this court, because ultimately she's responsible for the unpaid balance. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, very good. Ms. Graham?
May it please the court. Guardians urges that the court affirm the judgment below. There were two grounds that the district court found. They found that Dr. Joe failed to exhaust his remedies, and that's clear from the exhibits attached to the complaint. The standard review here is abuse of discretion. So Dr. Joe bears a heavy burden. Essentially has to show that no reasonable judge would have reached the same conclusion. As Dr. Joe's attorney just conceded, he bases his claim that he exhausted his remedy, actually claims that the pursuit of appeal was futile because Guardian refused allegedly to give him certain pertinent plan documents. The problem is under ERISA, the responsibility for providing pertinent plan documents is the plan administrator. Guardian is not the plan administrator. We explained to Dr. Show that we're not the plan administrator. Under ERISA, whereas here the plan does not designate a plan administrator, the plan sponsor is the plan administrator by default. We were designated the claims administrator, but we were not designated the plan administrator. In fact, the plan distinguishes Guardian from the plan administrator.
Was your company aware who the plan administrator was?
Apparently not, Your Honor. When we responded to Dr. Joe's letters, we explained to him that we didn't have that information, that he should contact the plan sponsor or Universal Casualty, the employer, to get that information. For whatever reason, Dr. Joe never did that. If he had, he would have been able to determine who the plan administrator was. As it turns out, it's probably the trustees of the plan administrator, a multi-employer plan. And under ERISA, where you have more than one employer, it's the board of trustees for those entities.
Well, how hard is it to get this SPD and this plan, and whether or not there's an anti-assignment clause and all that? Why is it just not available? It seems not to be.
Well, first of all, it's not Guardian's responsibility to provide beneficiaries or participants with the SPD. And when they responded to Dr. Joe, they explained to him, they gave him a copy of the insurance certificate, but they said, we're not holding this out as the SPD, and in fact, the plan administrator or the plan sponsor may have previously put out an SPD. And they were, I think, afraid of the same sort of conflict that Dr. Joe's attorney just mentioned. It wasn't their responsibility. They didn't have it. What they did do is they did explain where he could go get it, and unfortunately, Dr. Joe decided not to do that.
Just that simple. He just didn't do it. That's why he didn't exhaust his administrative remedies.
Well, he bases his entire futility argument on our refusal to give him pertinent plan documents. And if it's not our responsibility to give him the pertinent plan documents, he can't use that refusal or failure as evidence of futility. Did I answer your question?
Well, I guess. Is it normal that when someone, I don't know what the assignment is, how do you assign something? Is it just that the doctor says, have you signed something so that he can put in directly for the reimbursement?
I'm sure
when we go to the doctor and the doctor puts it through, so to speak?
When Mrs. Baker filled out her application for treatment with Dr. Joe, you know, part of that application included the assignment of benefits. And I'm sure that was Dr. Joe's intent that he would just deal directly. And under the plan, a guardian has the right to, at his discretion, deal directly with the provider without waiving the anti-assignment clause, which is what we did. Guardian paid almost all of the claims submitted by Dr. Schell.
He had a limit of 30 visits to the chiropractor, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
But there
and
was
after
also
that, you don't pay for anymore.
At least within the benefit year. Yes. And he had exhausted that benefit. But he also had submitted claims for acupuncture treatment, and Guardian had indicated that if he wanted to submit additional medical records to challenge the medical necessity determination regarding the acupuncture treatment, he could do so.
Now, that was Dr. Joe?
Yes.
He does that too, huh?
Yes. And again, Dr. Joe chose not to submit additional medical records. That's another basis for his failure to exhaust his remedy. And I have to point out again, too, that the standard for futility as an exception to the exhaustion rule requires that plaintiffs show or allege facts that show that a further appeal is certain to be unworkable. And here, he sought the documents from the wrong entity. We told him where he could go to get the documents that he claims evidences futility. We told him we would consider further medical records if he was dissatisfied with the resolution of the claims regarding acupuncture treatment. He didn't do that. He clearly could have pursued further remedies, and there's every chance that if he had done so, we wouldn't be here. And of course, that's the whole point of the exhaustion principle. I'd like to get to the anti-assignment clause, because it not only bars the beneficiary from assigning the right to benefit, it also barred Arlene Baker from assigning the right to sue Guardian. And that is why he has no standing to sue, and that is why it didn't come up when Guardian was dealing with Dr. Joe during those months. I mean, Guardian was willing to pay Dr. Joe for treatment that fell within the terms of the plan, under their discretionary authority under the plan, without waiving the anti-assignment clause. That's why they dealt directly with him. That's why they considered the medical records that he did submit, and that's why they invited him to continue submitting additional medical records. When Dr. Joe decided to sue, that's when Guardian asserted the anti-assignment clause as a defense to his standing to sue, which the plan expressly barred. I'd also point out that below we raised additional grounds for dismissal that the district court didn't reach. They're not make-weight arguments. I think they provide separate grounds for affirming here. Dr. Joe sued the wrong party under Seventh Circuit precedent. It's clear that he had to bring his benefits claim against the plan as an entity. And it's also clear that that many of the information that he requested is not required to be disclosed under ERISA. Dr. Joe's attorney mentioned the usual and customary fees. The court in DiBartolo, which we cite in our brief, explicitly held that Those charges, are, those sorts of information are not supposed to be required or provided under ERISA. Also, if you look at his requests, he basically required the entire claim file plus all sorts of other information, identities, attorney-client privileged information. It's clearly outside the scope of information required to be provided under ERISA. As the court held in Ames, ERISA requires disclosure of only formal legal documents governing the plan, and his request clearly exceeded that. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Apparently not.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Ginsky?
Counsel indicated that the DiBartolo precedent in this case indicates that with reference to information concerning medical necessity or usual and customary review are not documents that need to be produced. That's incorrect. There's a specific Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor advisory opinion, number 96-14A, that says those documents do have to be produced. The counsel also indicated that Dr. Joe sued the wrong party here. We kept telling him where he had to go in order to take care of this problem. They did not tell us that. What they said is you need to go to the plan sponsor or to the plan administrator. We repeatedly asked, who are those people? What entities constitute the sponsor or the administrator? We repeatedly got the answer, we don't know. In other words, we don't know who we're working for. We make charges, we get paid, but we don't know how that happens. We don't know who we work for. As evidence of that, in the word...
Let me just... Did Ms. Baker have no documentation in her possession as to this plan administrator?
I don't believe she did. Now, her husband was the employee of Universal, which was the sponsor,
right.
If I can... Well, the employer, let me put it that way. I believe that he had access to an SPD. Our concern was, is it the one that they're operating on under currently?
I understand. Thank you. All right, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court will proceed to the sixth.